you that I have an anxiety issue?
Hello and welcome to The Kind, The Creative and The Chaotic, the show where we all get to chill out, open up and sometimes, if not always, get a bit weird. I am joined by sound guy slash co-host Wayne Naylor as per. Are you alright?
Yeah.
Good.
That wasn't really much of an answer. I just went,
You seem so enthusiastic.
You're not meant to be here.
I know, but I just couldn't help it.
Sorry, do you want to redo it?
To be fair, I kind of
let's just like, keep that in.
My response was awful.
I'm like, sorry.
Right. But,
I'll pretend that I'm just walking in.
Okay. Rewind, selector. I am joined by sound guy slash co-host Wayne Naylor. You all right?
Yeah.
You know what it is? It's because I'm going to do something else. I'm joined by sound guy slash co-host Wayne Naylor.
Hey.
See, that's what you usually do. Yeah. That's where it went wrong. Sorry. Yeah. I lured you into a false situation.
No, you know it's funny because like whenever my mum's asking me a question, I usually answer her sort of like, And then she's like, what does that mean? And I was like, listen, I told you already, it's And it's just like, and she's like, yeah, but you know, it's the truth.
So how's your week been like? What's the tea?
The tea is that we continue to progress forward in a world that's slowly, rapidly failing. I'm joking. That's a bit too much. But
Is
I make cookies. Well, yes and no. It's morbid, but you know, there's a little bit of truth in there.
Yeah.
Very excited. Made some chocolate chip cookies with Lindt chocolate bars as the kind of chocolate chips.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty. I was pretty happy with that.
I mean, I'm happy with it because they're mine now. They belong to me.
Yeah.
And Lindt is my favourite chocolate, and you didn't know that.
No.
So.
No.
Thank you, Wayne.
Yeah, we're linked.
So how many times have you made cookies now?
Oh, this would be the fourth time.
Okay.
Yeah, first time was a disaster. You know, reminding me of secondary school, it's like, it's just one gelatinous blob. It's just a sheet of cookies. Great. Oh, love these square cookies. They taste great.
Yeah, just stick to crust sandwiches.
Yeah.
You can't go wrong.
Yeah, it was very, very much a sort of like slam my fist on the table. Like, how did I get this wrong?
Oh.
Then I found like a ridiculous recipe where you've got to like, it was pretty easy, but then they're like, you got to turn them into 100 gram balls, freeze them overnight. Put them in, get them out the next morning and then put them on a sheet and then you just cook them easily. And you can sort of like, but the thing that was cool about the recipe was, is that they can keep in the fridge for 2 to 3 months. So effectively it's like you could literally take out to cook and then keep on doing it as time went on.
That's nice.
And they turned out great.
Okay. And the thing is, this is the fourth batch. So I trust in your skills now. So I feel like they're going to be top tier, the best so far.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, I haven't tried them yet.
Wow.
But I can do a review next week.
You know, the heat is on.
Oh, also, it's your birthday soon, and you got an early present from me.
Yeah.
Have you watched any of the DVDs yet?
No.
Okay. Anyway, shall we move forward? Today's guest is also a big fan of film. She says, after he said he didn't watch the DVDs. Do you want to know who it is?
Yeah. After I've been called out like this.
Quentin Tarantino. No, we have Rowan Alice, awesome BBC radio entertainment reporter, fabulous DJ for propaganda around all of the UK, and last but most definitely not least, host of her own kick-ass show, Riot Diet, which is on super unique, top-rated London station Boogaloo Radio. I don't know about you, Wayne, but I'm ready to dive in. Thank you for joining us today.
You're very welcome. I got up at 7:30 this morning. There's not many people I'd do that for apart from you, Kelly. Oh. You're definitely one of those people. So.
Oh, thank you. I hope I bring a little bit of sunshine to your day.
Always bring sunshine to my life.
One thing that I do actually wonder when guests come on the show and they come into Shepherd's Bush Studios, I just wonder what the kind of like aura is, and you get to meet Wayne. Is it chilled? Is it weird? Is it... political? Probably not.
It's always a little bit weird with you, Kelly, but I'm super weird, so it's always a plus. No, it's very, very chilled out and relaxed and zen, and it's very nice. So thank you for having me. It's very chilled out. It's just nice to be on the other side of a microphone and desk instead of being the one just trying to control everyone. I can just sit back and be like, yeah, ask me some questions. I'll try my best to answer them.
Thing is, like, I can try to control people, but I'll never be able to control Wayne. So it's like a loose unit.
You rogue.
I'm like a wild dog.
Yeah, you just can't be tamed.
Spicy raccoon.
Rebel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A very chilled rebel.
Yeah. I'd be a bad rebel. I'd be like, oh, you know what? It's pretty hot out. Tomorrow?
Yeah. We'll start the rebellion later this week.
Ooh, how many miles we got to walk?
Rain check.
Got a golf cart handy? Yeah, we'll just poodle around on that. I'd love that.
You want to go to Bristol with hills? Ugh.
So, are we all settled and ready to get going on this journey?
I think so.
Yes. All right. Radio presenting. Tell us why, how and when, and did you always see yourself doing it?
So I started with radio through actually doing film reviews. So at university, I joined uni a little bit later because I left school when I was signed to be a model. Mm-hmm. I did that for a little while. It was horrible. It was not great for me. I was very thin at the time and I thought I can't carry on with this anymore. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to further my education. And that's why I went to university. And I, you know, being a bit older, I was like, I'm going to do something that I enjoy. I'm terrible like this. My sister, she perseveres with anything. My mum does. They work hard at any kind of subject. If I don't like it, I'm not going to do it. So
if the passion's not there, it's difficult, right?
Exactly. So I'd already been married as well. So I got married at 21. I was quite young. And I just thought, I'll go somewhere nearby that's got a course that looks like it's quite a bit of fun. And so I did a film and TV course. And I just took up every single opportunity that I could whilst I was there, which led to me doing something called the Elstree Project. And I ended up going to LA and San Francisco to interview Steven Spielberg, amongst other people.
Why do I not know this? That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so that was in my, I want to say, second year that I did that. So we managed to raise some funds. I went with a team of about five other students and one teacher. And we went over to Amblin Entertainment and we actually sat in his screening room and waited for him and we interviewed. So yeah, that was great fun, as well as some other people I got to chat to. I got to speak to Simon Pegg and film him as well, which was great. Lots of these kinds of people. And through doing the Elstree Project, I got to know Roberto Peroni, who is on BBC Three Counties Radio.
Okay, right.
Chatted to him a little bit and I said, you know what? Theory has always been my specialist subject when it came to film and TV. The practical stuff, not very good at, which is funny because now I've actually used the sound editing that I learned to be able to go and do that. And ultimately, I also did documentary, which meant that I could host and I was a director and I asked questions. So really, these little tips and tricks that I learned have helped me in sort of future life, whether even though I haven't gone into a practical route of doing film.
Yeah.
But I was always, my strong point was talking a lot and writing about film and TV. My final year dissertation was on The Simpsons, which piqued a lot of people's interest, and I won some awards with it, which was great, from the BFI, IB Taurus, and somewhere else. I also won an award from ITV for my documentary as well. So I think the fact that I got these in for my final year helped as well with getting attention from BBC Three Counties, who covered our university. And I just happened to then bump into him at another event. And I said, look, if you're ever looking for someone to do this, I chatted to his producer and said, you know, I really would love to do film reviews if you've got any space to do it. And then the August of the year that I graduated, someone said, do you fancy coming in doing a 5-minute film review of two films? And one of them was Straight Outta Compton. So I was like, what a cracking film to come on and talk about. And from there, I ended up actually becoming a showbiz reporter on Roberto's show on Fridays, 6 till 7 p.m., just getting to have a gossip about it. And from there, I moved on to actually hosting stuff and being a co-host. So I went to Hoxton Radio, which was good fun for a while, co-hosting the movie show as well as helping out on the fashion show. I've got an eclectic taste and enjoyment of things. And then started presenting myself on Hoxton Radio, but we didn't quite gel, me and the producer there, so, and the station manager. And that's how I ended up meeting Jen Crothers, mm-hmm. who set up her own station with Boogaloo Radio. And therefore, I went onto my journey there. But it's amazing, like, just going from a tiny 5-minute slot of just getting to know someone because I'm very passionate about things. And this is what I'd say to anyone who wants to get into presenting, is that you have to be very knowledgeable about your subject to try and get an entry point. There is no point just going in just being like, oh, I just want to talk on radio. Yeah. You have to know something and be passionate about it. And part of the reason that I've carried on doing Riot Diet on Boogaloo Radio with Jen was because my final year documentary was all about the need for feminism in rock music. And so it's been a big passion of mine. I think the year that we did it was the first time someone removed the names from the Reading and Leeds poster, which was obviously great for me to be able to put this up. And one of my friends, who actually was one of the only females like playing, I hate that word females, one of the only women playing on there, was obviously in my documentary. But it's just, again, my radio life has come from things that I'm really passionate about, but it's sort of opened doors to me, and I'm really grateful that I managed to get that BBC thing because it pushed me to being a presenter in my own right, not just a panelist or a co-host. And then that journey has then got me in through doors and meetings with other people on slightly bigger stations. So
I mean, like, the whole journey, I don't know anyone else that did that much at university and made so many opportunities for themselves. So that is pretty impressive.
I think that's the plus side of going a little later in life, is I'm here, I'm paying a shitload of money to do this. I might as well make the most out of the opportunities. I wasn't living on campus. So I wasn't swept away with all the kind of partying vibe. Being a little bit older as well, you know, I wasn't much older looking at it, and there were older people in my year than me. But I was just like, I need to do this. I need to give myself something that's hopefully going to turn into a career.
Something to go back to very quickly, because I saw Wayne's face as soon as the name was dropped. Steven Spielberg, what was he like? Do you want to know more about that situation?
Well, I need to know everything.
It was, so we went in there and it was just, oh, it was so weird. We stayed in this ratty motel in Burbank, because obviously that's where all the studios are. It's not the sort of nicer high-end bits of LA. It is like somewhere where you can imagine it's going to be on like American Horror Story. Pretty certain we put our chair up to our motel door, because I was just saying, with me and this other girl, Sean. And we were like, yeah, maybe we'll just like try and block it with our suitcases and stuff. And probably numerous animals had died in the pool. But, you know, we were there and we just didn't care, because we were like, this opportunity is just, we can't sort of miss it. And the fact that we'd been given this bit of a grant and some people had donated money for us to be able to do it was just like, we've got to do our best with this.
Yeah, totally.
And there were three guys, two women, so me and Sean. And so obviously the lads just did what they wanted, and that's where I first found out about people using Tinder, because they were like, oh my god, look at this amazing new app.
Tinder was going on then?
Yeah.
Really?
But this was like 2013, so this was when it was first, I think, starting to appear, and people were like, oh my god, look at this amazing app. So we went over. I remember we got a cab over, we were let in, we were given all our passes, which was scary, but I've still got it all at home, with like, to see visitors for Mr. Steven Spielberg.
Mad.
Sat in the entrance, and they're like, oh yeah, you're going to be in his personal screening room. So there's like this massive popcorn machine in there, and just all these red velvet seats, probably about 6 rows of seats, that's it. And we're there like trying to set up, trying to stay really calm, and just like, oh my god, this is so weird. And then we sort of see someone in this cardigan just like kind of looking through the window, and I said, I think that's him, I think he's looking down at us before he comes in. He's sort of just scoping the joint, seeing what we look like. He comes in, he's much smaller than I imagined him to be, I think, because he seems quite such an ominous presence when he's directing, because he's so massive in what he produces, but he was actually smaller than I thought he'd be. But he was lovely, he came, he shook all our hands, and he was just an absolute delight to talk to. He answered all our questions. He talked about how when filming Indiana Jones in Elstree Studios, they all went to Wimpy and how it's one of the only Wimpies that are left there. And it was an absolute joy. And then he just sort of said goodbye, shook our hands and left. And then we were shown out and all of us just trying to play cool, just like, oh my God, as soon as he left. And we're just like, oh, we just need to get it out of our system. But we were on a high for quite a while, and then it was on to the next sort of interviews over in San Francisco. So
just that, even that story is surreal to listen to, let alone live it.
I sometimes forget about it, and I still have these pictures that come up on my Facebook memories where the like clips of the interview were on BBC News, and you're like, that's so weird that I'm there behind the camera sort of organizing all of this and helping out with the questions. So some really surreal experiences, but I've met some amazing people and learned some fascinating stories, because the whole point of the Elstree project was that Elstree Studios, who we kind of did a lot of our work with, and I'm actually friends with the guy who runs it, Maurice Bright, Councilman Maurice Bright, I should say, because he's sometimes on the Showbiz Hour on BBC Three Cast as well. So it all sort of links up, so it's quite good getting to know people. And it's like they had, we did a documentary called The Rise and Fall and Rise of Elstree. So it sort of did really well. It did all these amazing things. Then it had this crash where nothing was really filmed there anymore. Mm. And then it came back around again when things like Strictly Come Dancing started being filmed there. But all your sort of the incredible films like The Muppets and stuff, that might not be like top notch film for a lot of people, but I absolutely adore it. And they were all made at Elstree. So yeah, it was just amazing hearing all these stories of sort of film history, really. But yeah, so that's my little story with Steven Spielberg. But yeah, you seems like a very nice bloke.
I've got some more questions.
Okay. Yeah, so go for it.
I thought you might,
With regards to Amblins, obviously they've been, their history is just well known. Yeah. Like, it's just ridiculous how much stuff they've done. Like, so inside the actual studio itself, like, are there like the posters from like Bruce Struzan and stuff like that?
Yeah,
from, like,
so old school. They had the current ones up, and I think the film he was working on at the time was an Aaron Paul film. I think possibly when he started becoming huge for Breaking Bad, I think it was a Need for Speed, something like that. So there was a lot of those, you know. Maybe not their best things, but there was also an E.T. there that I got to see. And I was just like, I was there thinking, oh, is there any free stuff that I could totally put in my pocket right now? And they wouldn't realise. But I just didn't want, I think I was just so bowled over by what happened. I just couldn't really do anything cheeky that would get me thrown out or like blacklisted for the future.
Did they have the original shot from Jaws?
Not where I went, no. We were very much funneled through a sort of secretary's office and then through into his screening room. So I think if we got to go outside, which was quite nice, and I think they had a few props there, but I didn't get to see anything that epic. But I think Spielberg was pretty epic enough. So
the biggest thing there.
Yeah.
So I guess, like, so sort of with hindsight, is there anything you wish you would have asked him, or something that was like left on the table that you thought, oh man, if I could only.
It's difficult because I think we literally only had 10 minutes, so we just tried to squeeze in everything we could, and it had to be very much for what the documentary was. It was all very scheduled, and I think we got quite a bit out of him, which was amazing. We did try to push to see if he could try and speak to George Lucas whilst we were over there, but he was like, oh, I'll see what I can do, and then it didn't happen. So yeah, we didn't get to go to his ranch or anything. So George Lucas, you suck. Spielberg's nice.
Yeah, but no, like, honestly, you lot seem very composed, because if that was me after the interview was done, I probably would have shot into orbit.
There was a picture of us in the cab on the way back just kind of almost screaming, but I think we were in so much shock it came out a little bit later. And luckily, this is where I was relieved, I was also the only person old enough to drink apart from my teacher when I was over there. So I was just like, yeah, just like keep pounding through the sort of beers and whatever you've got here, because I need it to try and get over my nerves, because I was sort of shaking so much. But we also had to stay quite composed, because we knew we had to make sure that we had everything. So we had to get all of the stuff off the system, make sure nothing was corrupted or lost, because, you know, this was the only opportunity we had. So we had to still get back, keep our heads level, right, okay, this is all we've got up here, just make sure it's all stored, backed up on like all of our laptops as well, because we just can't lose this footage. No. And then get ready for the next interviews. So, yeah.
You know, I imagine, because it's not like a case where it's like, oh, you know what? Get Stevie on the blower. So, you know, exactly. Round two. You know, got some footage. We were
so lucky we managed to get it. It was via Lee Unkrich, who works on a lot of Pixar stuff. And he just managed to get into conversation with my tutor at university. And he just said, okay, yeah, I'll try and see if I can set up a meeting. And he managed to do it just because he really liked what my tutor's work was. Yeah. But yeah, it was nice. It was a little difficult at times because I felt like being the second oldest person there, that I was having to be the other adult and sort of take care of people. But yeah, it was a really fun time.
And sorry, I will just say that you just like casually dropped Lee Unkrich, who directed Toy Story 3 and also directed Coco. So...
Yeah, I sort of I forget now because I'm so involved in the music world. I forget how much I'd done originally in the film and TV world. Like that was fully the direction I was going in with my career, was that sort of stuff and with the entertainment industry. And I still get to talk about it when I do the showbiz stuff and entertainment reporting for BBC, whether it's like on the phone, like talking about with BBC Wales, maybe saying about the new Lion King trailer or whatever. Okay. So I do little bits here and there as well, which is quite nice.
I think with creatives, more often than not, usually what they do can flow into something else that they're passionate about, or they find themselves in a situation that really suits them, but they didn't expect it to happen. But they've got all the skill set there because they've got the eye for it, or the ear, or whatever it is.
Very much two worlds colliding for me, because my uncle he's the reason I absolutely adore film. Like my mum is just like, yeah, film is a film. Her proudest achievement is that she didn't fall asleep in the cinema to Men in Black. You know, it's like, otherwise she tends to fall asleep. That, and then she also got to see Ghostbusters originally the first time round and said about how hilarious it was seeing the Stay Puft. Man, so those are her main cinema memories. She's got better, actually. We set up a little film club thing during lockdown, and I was like, I have to very much pick films I think she would like and that has a bit of sort of action or scariness from the beginning. So otherwise she's like, nah, I'm bored. But she's someone who will start watching a series and read how it ends just to make sure if she wants to keep watching it.
Oh my God.
So, yeah. So this is, you know, this is not where my sort of love of film and TV's come from. It's very much from my uncle Jonathan, who has written screenplays, and he had like quite a few opportunities, but life stuff got in the way that meant that that didn't happen. But he still really enjoys doing like his sort of script writing. He just sort of keeps it to the side, and he's made some short films and stuff like that. So obviously that's one part of my life. And then obviously I'm married to someone who's in a rock band, so that's very much, I'm exposed to a whole other industry with music. So I think being on radio and getting to talk about both, I'm a very, very lucky person.
Going into radio chat, Boogaloo, how long have you been there now?
So I started my show in February 2017.
And can you tell, if the listeners haven't had the chance to tune in yet, why is it so special? Because it's quite unique, isn't it?
The whole rule of Riot Diet, and it has adapted. I've completely changed the format to be more music, because originally I did rant a bit about news stories that were affecting women as well as them playing music by women. But life was just getting too depressing, having to talk about the same stories like each week. So obviously I put in the odd news story now, but now it's mostly a music show. But it's every band that I play on the show has to have at least one woman in to be played, or someone who identifies as a woman or who is non-binary. And that's the lore of my show. That's what I have to do. And, you know, it's a great way of just proving points to people when they say, oh, you know, when like this big band that claims to be feminist goes on tour and then they've just got a band to support them that's just all dudes and all white dudes, they're like, oh, well, you know, they're just not out there in this genre. And then I'm saying, well, each week on my show, I play like over 30 tracks by women, people of color, you know, just all these like incredible artists that are amazing live, creating the sort of future of music, really, you know, stuff that's like bending and shaping new genres and fusing them. And like, you get like Nova Twins who go on stage, people think they're going to be doing an R&B set, and then it's like this grime rock rap sort of metal fusion, and it's just glorious to behold. And I was playing all these sort of bands like years ago, and now suddenly they're on Radio 1, which is amazing to see. But it just means that I can be a little bit like, whoa, I can just provide you a playlist if you want to show that these people are out there. Yeah. And just every year I have the same thing with like Reading and Leeds festivals. Like, oh, right, we're here again. Let's dig out this tweet from before and just say, yeah, if you want some ideas, go to Riot Diet. So yeah, that's the rule of my show. I've always been very passionate about women in music. Like my husband's band's got a woman in. And I've seen what she's gone through over the years because I was at school with Charlotte, so I've known
her. Didn't know that.
Yeah, she was in the same year as my sister at school. So we've got lots of sort of connections. I've seen them playing from very sort of small venues when they were known as Platypus and Mustard Seed, which were the original names to my husband's band, who are now the Subways. And it's just something that I've just really enjoyed. I also loved listening to women in rock and indie and punk. And whilst I've never really been able to play instruments myself, I used to like to sing, and just the idea that you could see people who are like yourself on stage was amazing. And it was only when we sort of started coming into the indie explosion, we saw some of these women were getting back on stage.
Yeah.
But I very much, it was from the grunge period that I loved it. You know, you've got all your sort of Riot Girl stuff with Bikini Kill, then you move into your grunge era and you've got Hole and L7, Slater Kinney, all these incredible bands that we're now having a resurgence of, because obviously we feel like we need sort of feminism again. Because whenever you get a space where, you know, we start speaking out online, so we get a bigger platform, whether it's YouTube, where we get to play stuff, or on Twitter or Instagram, there's always going to be a pushback. And, you know, that's why you've got Trump in charge. It's because we had a progressive president, and then suddenly it's like, okay, let's have a pushback with someone who's the complete opposite. It's always going to happen. It sucks, but it seems to be the way the world moves at the moment. And it's just, yeah, I've always really enjoyed that music. I've always been a big fan of grunge. Like, I grew up listening to Nirvana. I remember when my uncle, again, like a big influence on me, gave me the first cassette of Nevermind, and it just blew my mind that music could sound this way. And that was my entrance into sort of grunge and all that stuff. And, you know, Kurt Cobain, again, he was very progressive. If he wanted to wear a dress on stage, he'd wear a dress on stage. He was like, so if you're a racist or a homophobe, don't buy our music, don't come to our shows.
Yeah.
And it's just all very much a genre I love to be in. It was great in the 2000s when I was sort of starting to get with Billy, and I was very involved in the scene there, seeing women back on stage. It then died down a little bit, but it was something which is why I did my documentary. It's always been something I'm passionate about, and I just find it gives a new dimension to music. It gets so tedious just hearing the same sort of male vocals, the same kind of performances, whereas if you've got like dual vocals or like a bit of female vocals with a great range, it's like, oh, it's just so much more exciting. And that's what I love. And like the fact that I've now got this huge Rolodex of all these artists and bands that I've just gathered over the years from doing Riot Diet, it's just like, it's pretty much all I listen to. So doing the show is not hard, because it's like, oh right, what new releases have I got from my artists now? And yeah, so there you go, that's what Riot Diet is. It's all about sort of supporting women in rock, indie, punk and alternative music.
One thing I will touch upon actually is the fact that for years, and we've spoken about this in the past, you are the only person that I can think of that really touched upon feminism on your platform and when it came to music shows or just like pushing for it. And then maybe a year or so ago,
it exploded.
But then some people would take it on board as a trend and they'd, you know, they'd push T-shirts for feminism, and you get it with LGBTQ plus mouthful. And it just, I don't know, I just found that you always did it and you were always shouting for it. So it's frustrating when I see certain people that seem to be in a higher position for pushing things like that when you've always been doing it.
I think it's tough, and there have been times, cause I'm one of these people that I sort of hate when I'm being copied. But, you know, even just since doing Riot Diet Show, there are people that I've worked with or I've come across who are doing very similar shows now.
Yeah.
And a part of me is like, okay, this really sucks because I've been putting the work in for a while. But then also you have to kind of be like, okay, well, it's flattering that they're doing this, and also that they're sort of raising their awareness and they are trying to sort of help the cause in their own way.
But it is tough. But then ultimately, the only reason I was able to start doing my shows is on the backs of other women who've been working really hard for years with like the Riot Girl movements. And then before then, obviously, you've got like the different waves of feminism. So ultimately, there is always going to be a new resurgence where there's going to be people who've been working on it behind the scenes where it's been really tough.
Yeah.
And like Laura Mary from Blood Red Shoes, she found it quite difficult because when it was the Reading and Leeds 2014, actually, when I was making my documentary, she was the only band on the main stage that had a woman in. And she said, I want to make a statement. I want to gather all these other artists and bands with women in. I want them all to come on stage with me. They refused, including people who are now very, very well known and have also made documentaries with the BBC about feminism in music. And she was like, well, at the time, as soon as they were starting to try and sort of get bigger into a stronger position, they stayed quiet because they thought it could affect their career.
Yeah.
And I'm really torn on this issue because ultimately it's like, I get it. It's really hard to push your way through. I probably would be further in my career if I wasn't so outspoken about stuff. And there are things I've been told that I have to rein in. And as I'm trying to like do more work with BBC or wherever, maybe I pick and choose my fights a little more. Whereas before I'd just be constantly at it all the time. But that's not great for your mental health either. You have to sort of be restrained and know when to sort of battle and fight with this kind of stuff. But it's tough because you see these people that maybe are well known from other things and who have also, there are some people that I know that I've worked with on BBC Showbiz Hour that sort of almost took the piss out of how passionate I was about stuff. And now suddenly, as their daughter gets older and they're starting to set up their own business, they're now launching this big brand and sort of range of t-shirts with feminist slogans, or suddenly appearing very left-wing after being like voting Tory for their whole life and sort of taking the mickey out of me for getting quite angry and passionate about the fact that there's not enough representation in a certain film. And it's tough when you see them then going and sort of making money and then being getting the plaudits and applause for doing all this stuff. It's like, ah, it does great on you. But then you think, okay, well, how would I, like, surely I've done that battle for a reason. I've been there doing it, not just because I want to get sort of success or people going, oh, well done you, you're doing such a good job with this. It's because I actually want change. And I have to remind myself of that sometimes when I'm feeling a little frustrated or angry at people. It's like, I've been doing the work that I've been doing, as have people before me, as have some of my friends, when it's been harder, so that it's easier for younger generations or other people to learn from their mistakes and to change and to have the information there ready for them when they've decided that they want to progress with their views and ideas. So it can be tough, but I think it's also very, very important to remember why you were doing it in the first place.
Yeah,
because otherwise we get nowhere if we were just trying to tear each other down. So whilst it can be hard seeing people using your work, I've seen people lift almost like my whole playlist from things, but then I'm like, you know what, they're listening to the music, they're listening to these bands, they're getting them streams, they might be buying it and sharing it to other people. It's giving it a wider network. Okay, other people might think it's come from their show first, but I'm playing this music to be heard, and it's getting heard, whether it's via me or someone else.
When it comes to mainstream music, women in mainstream, you've got people like Billie Eilish, is that how I say it? And Lizzo. I think there's a slow progression because obviously Billie dresses exactly how she wants to dress, like oversized hoodies, tries not to be over-sexualized. And then Lizzo is obviously a bigger woman. And so this is something that I think is quite new to be like overtly accepted. Obviously there's a bit of pushback from it, but
yeah, it's difficult because on the outset it looks really great and like they're accepted, but then you've got Billie Eilish, as soon as she turned 18, people trying to share pictures of her wearing not as much, and she's like, well, I can't win, I get slagged off for if I'm wearing clothes that are looser, but if I dare to wear something that's slightly more form-fitting or a little bit less stuff, I then get attacked for that. She's like, I can't win.
Yeah.
And this whole thing with it, in this like in our world, we're so desperate to sexualize people as soon as they get to sing. It's like, there is no difference between her now suddenly being 18 to when she was like 17 and 16. Really, that time, even though you feel a lot more grown up, looking back at it now from my age, you know, where I was there sneakily sort of trying to get drinks and stuff, I look at people of that age now, I'm like, God, you were so young. You were such a baby. And it's, we've got this horrible tendency to just try and tear women down no matter what. It's like there's always going to be double standards. We could have a guy singing who's got, he's quite a big guy and he'd be very sort of proud of his weight, has this amazing voice, but it's, even though people might say, oh, maybe he's not that healthy or it's this, it just doesn't get torn down in the same way that Lizzo does.
Yeah.
And again, you just have to see the comments under her pictures, or like when BBC Six Music were showing her Glastow performance, the stuff people said about her was atrocious.
Yeah.
So whilst it's great we're seeing more of these people in the mainstream, actually behind the scenes, it's still really tough. There is still so much further to go. And just in the industry, you just have to look at what's happened with Burger Records, you know, that have now been completely sort of taken down. And it's the drummer from Singers, Swimmers, who happens to be also Billy Joe Armstrong's son from Green Day.
Yeah.
Privilege alert or what, you know, he's also behaved in a really inappropriate way. And then you just see that these people have used their privilege and platform to sort of groom young fans and like young girls, and also these women in bands have just been treated terribly. So whilst it seems like we're being more progressive and we're seeing more people out there, actually there's still so much work to do.
I mean, Wayne, what do you think about women in music? Like, I'm interested to see your thoughts. Is it something that you really think about, or is it just...
It was funny when you were talking about sort of like the issues with indie rock and pop, because I've only recently been getting into it. Funny enough, from all the places, it was Vine
that
sort
of
got me into sort of like, I heard one song, I was like, oh, that's really cool. Who's this band?
Wait, it
was
this band. The app Vine.
Yeah, the app Vine. Oh. So there would be songs that would sort
ye
of get popular,
TikTok.
But it was on, So I was like, but there was this band called Sales. So I was like, I checked out Sales, and then through them, I was like, okay, let's see who else is on there. And I did, you know, Spotify, you know what, it gets a lot of shit, but it has exposed me to so many artists. So through that, I found Heliotropes, found Dreamwife, Angel Olsen, Courtney Barnett.
Amazing.
I found so many female acts, and they became my favorites to some extent. Like Jay Sun, she's really great, and Japanese Breakfast is really cool as well. So in my head, it was like, oh, this is indie pop is where it's at for like female musicians. So it didn't even pop into my head that obviously it must have been quite difficult. But then I think about my favorite genre, the genre that I grew up with, and it's rap music. And rap music, I love it to death, but it has treated women really poorly, and specifically female rappers really poorly. You know, if we look at someone like Lil' Kim and Foxy Brown in the 90s, they were doing incredible work. You know, Foxy Brown was on tracks with Jay-Z and holding her own lyrically against one of the greatest rappers of all time, and she does not get enough credit for that. You know, Lil' Kim, you know, she was on that song Get Money with one of Biggie's greatest verses, and she has to come right after one of the best verses, guest verses I've ever heard in a song, and she still holds her own, and she's still memorable on that song. She doesn't get enough credit. You know, there are female rappers like Bamadia, who is from Philly. She got bigged up by The Roots, but, you know, she's almost forgotten in time, but not enough people know about her. You know, you've got Gangsta Boo, who's with 3-6 Mafia. She's great. She was recently on a Run the Jewels track, Walking in the Snow. And she's really cool. Like, there are so many female rappers, and sometimes I hear some fans that, oh, you know, they wouldn't, you know, this sentiment that, oh, if they were good enough, they'd be up there with the big stuff. I'm just like, no.
It's...
But they are good enough. They've put out work. They've done great stuff. You know, even now, Jean Grey, Rhapsody, so good. Only getting their flowers right now, and it sucks.
But this is the problem, you know, the entertainment industry as a whole, we very much believe that sort of genius is only afforded to a man. And that is beyond ridiculous, and often it's more because they are sort of given the time and space from sort of society and in life that they can just go and be creative. They can just lock themselves away somewhere, which women usually aren't afforded in that way. But it just, it's so crazy that such a sort of toxic atmosphere is still created for women, that it's like, okay, well, you know, if you just worked harder, or if you just created something a bit better. But it's not, it's all the people on top who are just saying, what's going to sell? What's the safe option?
Yeah.
It's going to be these guys that we already know, or she can just be a backing singer, or, you know, we won't sell her as a rap artist. We'll sell her as something that's possibly going to make us a bit more money by maybe squeezing her into the R&B box a little bit more, or the pop acts. You know, that's where you tend to see women come into the forefront, because they're seen as like safer options. But you just see with rock and indie, like the Charlotte from the Subways, like my husband's band, she can be on stage, she's like thrashing around with a bass guitar, singing at the same time, and she still has someone shout "get your tits out" to her, or people sort of make a comment on her voice when they're like, because it's a little bit higher than other people's. And that's still happening now, and she's been doing it since she was like 17, I think. So they've just celebrated their 15th anniversary of their first single that's come out. 15th. Yes. Wow. And it just blows my mind that, you know, you still go on stage and you get people going like, oh, are you the like girlfriend of so-and-so on the stage? No, I'm actually here. And it's the same with like drummers as well. It's like, oh, women aren't strong enough to drum, or whatever trashy, there's always some kind of argument against it that's just to try and hold women back. But, you know, they're playing the best music and they're putting more into their live shows because they have to work harder.
Yeah.
Instead of just going and seeing like four dudes dressed up in like top shops, like top man suits, just doing the same kind of dreary stuff or sort of faux sort of punk thing that seems to have become very popular since Idols. Just all these blokes being like, oh my God, look, we're so disenfranchised and we're so disillusioned. Now we just want to try and rip off Idols because they've done really well with their kind of music. It's like, you know what? Go to a fucking punk gig with women.
Yeah.
They are throwing themselves around on stage. They're getting into the audience with you whilst also playing some of the best music you're going to hear. It's like, get out of this mindset that like the arts and films, like best men are like best directors are men, or the best instrument players are men and this stuff, because it's just complete rubbish. And it's just widen your horizons and you'd be surprised about what it will do to you sort of mentally, culturally, politically. It's like, just, you know, broaden those horizons a little bit more. You might enjoy it.
One thing I hear a lot is the whole thing of women not being funny, and that's why there aren't that many women comedians on TV. It's like, no, they're just not given the opportunity. Like, my girlfriends are hilarious. Yeah. So I don't know, it's like men don't want women to be funny or to have that platform or to be able to make a joke of things and be lighthearted. And
but also, if you think about a lot of the sort of funniest women are talking about their own experiences, and unfortunately a lot of our experiences come from misogyny, sexism, and sort of these microaggressions we suffer on a day-to-day basis. So men don't want to hear this on stage. They don't want their world reflected to them to be like, actually, I'm part of the blame. She could be talking about me with this. And it's the same with the men who are like the male comedians. You know, they don't want to feel that these women are getting power, because there's this, in all like facets of the world, there's this whole idea that if more presence is like being shown, like there's more presence of women or people of color or the LGBTQ plus scene, they're suddenly like, oh my God, it means that I'm losing my power. I'm losing my presence in society. And it's complete rubbish. It's like, just because you're sharing piece of the pie doesn't mean that you're being oppressed. And it's that whole thing, isn't it? It's like, when you're used to privilege, suddenly sharing it suddenly feels like you're being oppressed. And it's like, actually, no, it's not. It's just because someone else is on the same position of you doesn't push you down. It's just raising them up. And unfortunately, I think a lot of these guys still struggle with that. They still feel that, you know, just how many people now are saying that, oh, yeah, it's like, we feel really like emasculated, or we struggle with this, and it's like really tough to be like a white guy now because we're just blamed for everything. It's like, well, no, you're not blamed for everything, because if you're a nice guy, you're a nice guy and you're going to get kudos for that. But structurally, you've been a big part of the problem. And if you've not spoken out and you clearly benefit from these power structures, then you are part of the problem. And it's going to be uncomfortable and it's going to be tough. I'm a white woman. Whilst I don't have the same privilege as a white man, I've got more privilege than a woman of colour. So it's like, I have to own that up and like deal with the fact that it's easier for me maybe trying to push through onto radio or whatever because of like the way I look compared to some other people, which is part of the reason with my show, I speak out about this stuff, even if I've had a backlash from it. I'm like, well, I've just got to deal with it. If I do something wrong, you apologise. You say, okay, thank you for informing me of that. I will learn, I will move on, and I will grow, and I hope you're okay. Mm. It's just what you do. But I feel that these people who are so used to being like, oh, we're the funny dudes, we're the ones getting the laughs, we're the ones getting like all the groupies and the love and the sort of audience, they just hate sharing it. They just don't want to feel that they're losing their place in society. When they're not, they're never going to. It's going to be a long old time and we'll probably be in our graves by the time that we have some sort of form of equality across the board.
Yeah.
But, you know, they just need to just deal with it in the meantime and just grow up.
When it comes to this industry, I don't know, I often struggle with things like imposter syndrome and feeling frustrated. Is it something that you find yourself battling a lot? And do you have any like key ways of getting through that?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I really struggle. Like, I'm very open about the fact that I suffer with depression. I've been on antidepressants since I was 18. It comes in various forms, whether it's just that I just can't really get out of bed to then just being really anxious, and like recently through lockdown suffering from panic attacks, which was a fun development.
I feel that.
But it's part of the reason that I do this kind of work is that I feel that I've got more power and control over it because it's to do with me. And if I feel well enough to go and do a show, then I'll do a show. But again, I'm in a privileged position. I'm married to someone who's in a band that's fairly successful. I have a support network around me that if I fail, I'm not suddenly going to be homeless. So it's very easy for me to say that. Like, if I don't feel well enough to go and do things, maybe I'll have a day off or something like that. So I have to own that up. You know, I'm lucky in many ways. But there are times where I just, like, when I'm on stage and stuff, I'm just doubting. I'm doubting my abilities. I've gone to a big radio station. I got so het up before doing this demo with them. I was just like, I can't do it. I can't do this. I was just like, I just freaked out. And then I sort of also looked at the station and thought, you know, they've got all these really young guys on there. And then the few female presenters they have are a little bit older. And I'm like, is this because before they try and push to actually get on there, they're like, I need to make sure I've done this preparation, I've got this experience, feel very secure in myself in this way. Whereas I think some of these younger guys kind of just go in and go, right, I can do this, I'll wing it. And I do try to sometimes put that attitude like onto myself a little bit, going, okay, well, I'm, you know, hopefully I'm smart enough that if I put myself forward to this, I can try my best and I can adapt and see what I can do. And you've just got to push yourself because otherwise you're never going to sort of grow and move. And in this industry, especially when you're going to like DJ, I went from DJing very small things to being like, okay, like this propaganda offer came up. I did a sort of dual trial set with Dan, who runs Propaganda, and I was lucky that he was like, yeah, you're sort of 90% there, really, because it's a very set sort of thing that you're playing.
Right.
But I went from that to him like 2 weeks later saying, someone's pulled out of this gig, can you go and cover for me? And I thought, okay, right, this is gonna be a 5-hour gig till 3 a.m. with a whole room of people all on my own. Yeah. We're still not, like, this was me still building up my sort of music folders and this stuff. It's all very nicely organized now. I've got like my warm-up hour and my build-up and like my peak time and all that sort of stuff, but this was before that. And I thought, you know what, I'm just gonna go give it a try. If it's a disaster, then I don't get to do it again, but you never know. And then I've been working with them for a couple of years because I push myself. But I get very anxious. I also take it to heart when people say stuff that's negative to me. So I've been at gigs, and again, unfortunately, being a woman in the public eye, if I say that I'm not going to play a certain thing that someone wants, I have had a lot of like verbal abuse thrown at me, which can be tough. And then whilst you try and get through it, I'm one of these people that I have resting bitch face. So if I'm not happy, it will show through the rest of my set. It's like I will get on with the job, but if it was particularly nasty, it's going to really affect me. And then it's going to take me a bit of time before I want to go back to it. But you have to sort of try and speak to those inner demons and be like, okay, what is it really that upset me there? Was it this person? Well, okay, they might not be there next week. Okay, hopefully we can move on. It might be one of your best gigs of your life if you go back. So you've got to try and do it. But it's easy for me, Captain Hindsight, saying like, this is how I was back then, you know, just going, oh, you know, it's really easy when you're in this position. But there have been times where I've really struggled to leave the house to go and do this work because it's a performance. Yeah. It's, you know, you put on another version of yourself. I think I tweeted something recently about how everyone thinks that DJs and radio presenters are really sociable. But it's like, actually, it's because we don't really like being around people. We have the appearance of being sociable because we deal with people and they come to our booth, or we do interviews with people, or we're talking to a lot of an audience, like via a microphone. But actually, we don't really have to come into contact with that many people. And I think that that's how I sort of deal with it. It's like I kind of give this outward appearance that, okay, here's me, here's DJ Rowena, I can perform in this way, I can talk behind the microphone. But also I'm very critical of myself afterwards. I'm like, okay, what could I have done better? There's this. I've never really walked out of anything going, I did that 100% amazingly. And I think that's the sort of anxiety. Like, my mum's had depression anxiety for like her whole life as well. And I think we're very sort of critical on ourselves, and I find that sometimes stunts me with pushing forward in my career. I'm also like, my partner suffers from depression as well, so we're that typically creative household where if we're on a high, it's superb, we are doing our best work. But when one of us, and obviously that then affects the other one, is low, it is tough. It is a tough atmosphere to be in and be creative, and you're constantly having to be like, you know, just on the ball with stuff and being like, okay, how can I stay relevant, how can I do this? And I am one of the worst people as well to be like, oh yeah, you know, live your best life, do what you want, don't care about what these people say. But you know me, Kelly, I'm one of the worst people from comparing myself to others and being like, what could I have done that put me in this position? It could be something that's completely out of my control. They might have connections in ways that I don't have connections. They might just have a certain look that is very suited. They might be a little bit younger than me. I started this at a slightly older time in my life. You know, there's always going to be factors, and you can either have it just, and I've had to really be strict on myself with this. My mum has helped because, you know, my mum's sister are teachers. They're very realistic. They just keep doing their work like as it comes. And my mum's like, you've chosen this industry to be in. You either try and go, yes, that's really crap that you didn't get that job and that person did, but you either move out of it and you go and find another job, or you have to just knuckle down, think how you can approach this a different way, coping mechanisms. Maybe sort of just mute that person for a little bit whilst you're feeling angry about it, and you sort of get a bit of zen yourself and feel better about yourself. But, you know, again, it's all so much easier said than done. But I think what's important to know is that to find a small group of people around you that you feel that you can confide in. And you're one of those people for me as well, is that someone that you can trust, that you can have a bit of a grumble, you can have a bit of a moan about stuff, but that it's going to stay there. And I think whilst I'm not one for like loads of gossiping and bitching, because I think it can become quite nasty, and there's no point saying that I'm a feminist if I'm then trying to tear other people down. But I think sometimes you need to be able to vent, and you've got to have a friend who's going to realistically, like my mum does, realistically tell you, okay, it is rubbish, I get why you're feeling really like poo about this. But you've also got to remember this, this and this. And it's amazing how it can suddenly just refocus your attention. Be like, okay, yeah, that's true, actually. What can I do? I either sit here just wallowing for another 2 weeks, or I go, okay, right, what's my next plan of action? And also, like, lists are great for that. So realistic mum, lists, and friends who will be supportive, but also tell you how it is when you need to be told. Because in this industry, you'll never survive just being sort of coddled. You have to be realistic. You know, again, a lot of people see what I'm doing and think that, oh, she must be really successful. I have no money. I am very, very poor for someone who's like doing okay with my levels of being like on BBC and DJing. And obviously now with lockdown, I'm not got any work for the foreseeable future that's paid, but you have to do a lot of unpaid stuff. But this is where I go back to the fact that, you know, I'm lucky because I've got a bit more of a support network with having a creative husband at home who, if I suddenly just like lost all my work, it'd be like, okay, we're okay for a little bit before you start making money. But you have to be realistic, whether in the arts, it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be the point that you're having to do loads of stuff for free and exposure and whatever. But the reason I'm in the position I am now is a lot of the stuff I've done is for free.
Yeah.
And sort of just to try and support others. And then it's like, oh, okay, maybe in the future I can bring that favor in. It's like on Tuesday coming up, I've got a chat, an informal Zoom chat with someone who's fairly high up in an organization that has come from a meeting I had with someone from work I was doing in 2017.
Yeah.
And so it's just showing, you know, be good, have a nice online presence, be a nice person, be supportive to people. You never know how that is going to come back around. So no matter how rubbish you're feeling, just remind yourself other people are in the same position and don't be a dick. And hopefully you will get through it and you will be able to succeed despite the sort of imposter syndrome and anxiety saying that you don't belong there. You know, hopefully you can push that to one side and just be like, one day you'll be sitting on your sort of throne of whatever you want to be doing going, oh, what was I worried about? You know? And I also feel that the best stories of success and also longevity with careers has come from working your way up there.
100%.
You know, it's my husband's outdone so many, he's never become massive with his band, but he's outdone so many of these bands from the 2000s where, you know, they kind of got into it because they had someone who's famous in the industry or family, someone's like, you know, a rich kid or they've come from a private school. He was working class council house kid. And when he got his first paycheck from Warner's, when they got signed, he divvied it up between his family and helped lift them out of the situation they're in. And it's from that work and having to persevere, because you know that if you don't do this and you've got everything to lose. I think those are the kind of stories that are the best success ones. It's just like I find that really frustrating, how many people I'm like, oh, this seems like a really good actor, a really good musician, then you suddenly find out that it's like, dad is a actor here and mum is a production producer. And you're like, yeah, Of course it is. And it's always going to be the case in this industry. Nepotism is a real problem. And it's got a little bit worse because we're going through that phase now of where we're getting all the famous sort of Hollywood things of the 90s. All their kids are now coming into it.
Yeah.
And it's the same with music. Yeah. We're getting all like those kind of rock stars, and like Bono's kid is now all in this sort of band. And I think it's just important to be aware of it as well. Do a bit of research into your favourite band and be like, oh, like, can I be like this band? If there's someone that's a famous, like, got a famous parent, be like, oh, okay, maybe it's going to be a little bit harder for me, because they just automatically having a name of someone in your family who's in the industry, it steps you up. Connections, friendships have been made. Money is usually okay. And if, like, in the music industry, and I wrote an article about this a couple of years ago, when actually Glastonbury had mostly privately educated acts, this whole thing, and it's worse under the Tories because they see music and drama as softer subjects. That's where a lot of working class kids learn. Like, they get to play instruments at school. They get to go to these after school clubs that are all now just being closed down. And so what's left, it's all the people who haven't had to struggle in life, or they're like, mummy and daddy bought them a guitar that's then been, they've got tuition that they can have like paid after school and this sort of stuff. So it's difficult. Nepotism will always be an issue in the industry. But yeah, just do a bit of research for your favourite bands, and don't get me started on 1975, because I can feel it coming and I know that he's
okay,
well known. Mm-hmm. But yeah, famous mummy and daddy. So
moving back onto you.
Yes.
You are now represented by female and queer agency Iconica.
Yes, I am.
With lovely Luca. So that's quite a recent thing, right?
Yeah, so we've been in conversation a little bit for, I'd say, since earlier in the year, so pre-lockdown. And I've been looking for sort of representation for a while. I had it with one company that was run by two dudes that are like, oh yeah, it's all we're pro-female and stuff. absolute trash, honestly. They just, again, it's one of those classic things of where it's just a selling point where they get loads of women that look nice on the website, but they don't actually get them much work or support. So I've been looking around for a while just to have someone sort of in my corner a little bit, because pretty much all my sort of connections and bits of work I've got myself. But if I could have someone there that is just pushing a little bit for me.
Yeah.
And I just saw her and I saw her values. And obviously I know that she worked with Noisy Kitchen. I'd been in conversation with them before, but I think they're very much more into representing established acts, you know, like Mel C and whatever from Spice Girls, those kind of people, presenters and people who are like Fern Cotton, because it was her agency. And seeing that she'd obviously worked there originally, she had connections with people, she focused on like all the same kind of values that I have with my show. And I sent her a message before lockdown, just being like, oh, by the way, there's this, this and this. I don't know if you'd be interested. I'm looking for representation. She said, oh, well, I've just done an announcement. I'm still very new. I'm going to look at maybe reopening my books at some other point. We stayed in contact and I did a charity gig for her. Do you remember when it was on the live stream?
Yes, I do.
For food banks.
And were you wearing like a sparkly dress?
I was, yeah. I did a disco set in a little dress, no shoes on.
Cup of tea.
Cup of tea in hand. Because again, when I DJ, I'm used to having something in my hands and I feel really awkward. That's why doing these live stream sets has not been something I've wanted to do. I'm someone that's very much there, bitch, like singing along, just like, yes, with everyone, just enjoying life. And so I just feel really awkward when I'm not sort of there being able to like fiddle on my desk, because I'm used to using nice big Pioneer desks. So just my laptop and this little mixer, I'm just like, this is really awkward. But I was just like, I'm in my husband's studio, just gonna sort of have fun with it, do a disco set. It was meant to be child friendly. So I was like, everyone loves a bit of disco, especially like kids go this phase where they go massively into like ABBA, and then that opens the door to all this other disco. So I was like, oh, I'll do this set. And so I wore a sparkly sort of disco-y dress with it. She said there was a really great response with it. We carried on talking. And then I just sent her another message again saying, look, I'm in talks with a few people for work things. I know it's crazy at the moment. I know I can't get any gigs, but would you be interested in representing me? And she just went, yeah, screw it, let's do it. And then she announced me the next week that I was part of her little team. So I'm very grateful for that.
I mean, especially, so you said that happened in lockdown.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I feel things like that are like little power-ups for creatives. Yeah, it's kind of absolutely. Like, okay, another thing under my belt, I've got this, somebody else believes in me. Yeah. Someone can see what I'm trying to put out, what I'm trying to do. Mm. So, yeah.
It was lovely. Awesome. It was just a nice sort of affirmation, I think, because I've lost my identity by losing my DJ work.
Mm.
And a lot of us have. It's been a really tough time for people in our industry, you know, like my colleague at Propaganda Cambridge and friend of mine, he took his own life. And I think it's just because we didn't see any kind of future with what's coming with work. And, you know, luckily I've got a very tight sort of knit support network around me of like family and friends, but not everyone has that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm lucky I've got another creative outlet doing radio, and I've been able to do that from either my partner's studio or home now that I've got a little setup that I've created. Other people don't have that. They just had their DJ stuff and then maybe a slightly more conventional job on the side that they were doing. But when you can't do that and you're worried about money, finances, when you're going to get back to work, some people have seen that there's been no option but to do this. And three people within our DJ circles have taken their own life. And I've also had a friend in the creative industry recently who's been on the verge of doing that.
Mm.
And it sucks. It really sucks. You know, we've only just had some form of injection into the industry, but we're already looking at places that are possibly closing down. And they're already saying now with like how much money you get as someone who's self-employed. And again, in our kind of work, it's very erratic. You sometimes get a good year, you sometimes get a bad year. And they just like, I think for my self-employment grant, I got a fraction of what I made in a month. And that was meant to last me for 3 months. Because it was from a year when I was just starting out with my DJ stuff.
Yeah.
And there are other people who've obviously got to pay their rent and stuff. And with me, I know there are other people in the same position, you know, like musicians and stuff like that. But often they've usually got merch and they've got sort of songs that you can buy. We very much rely on just people coming out and sort of partying and drinking and having a good time. And even though people are going back to pubs and clubs, which has been, it's, it's almost, I think I almost started getting more anxious about stuff when I started seeing places open, because it almost feels like things are going back to normal, but they're not for me.
Yeah.
So whilst I'm seeing some of these pubs that I used to DJ in that are opening, you know, they're very much sit down table service. And even if, say, they were getting more people in, when they've had to pay so much money to try and refit all of their pub and club, the last thing they're thinking of is paying a DJ to come and entertain people, when to them they could maybe just put on a playlist that will do it. It's like, it's not the same job. You don't have that kind of atmosphere. You can't read it like Spotify playlist, can't read the room in the same way that we do, or do requests in that kind of way. But when you're struggling for money, which a lot of these places are, they've lost so much, you know, that some of these places haven't even been able to open. Some of the places are lucky to open, but they still can't pay all of their staff. They're having to keep some furloughed. They're not going to be suddenly going, oh yeah, come on, let's get you back. Let's get you back DJing. And it's a scary time. Like, people keep saying to me, oh, when do you think you're going to get back to work? And I'm like, I don't think it's going to be till there's a vaccine, which is well into next year. And it's the same with, you know, my partner, he's a live musician, so he needs big groups of people. And he went on tour, started an anniversary tour, did 3 gigs, and then it was pulled.
Yeah.
And it was like, he's had time off to write the new album and go to uni, and his bassist had had a baby. And they were like, okay, right, that's it, we're coming back. This is all our sort of big thing. It's like getting the bank account a little sort of fuller and looking a bit better, ready for when we're releasing the new album. And then suddenly it's like, you're just jolted away from it. And like, my husband, he really suffered from it, because he is someone that needs that high of being on stage and like touring. He's a recovering sort of addict and alcoholic, so again, this is him, this is where he gets his real kick and his rush now. So when then he just feels like he's this sort of not a nobody, because obviously he knows he's not, and he's still got a lot of support, and he's still getting to make an album because he's producing this album as well, so he's very much getting to spend time in his studio, which he's lucky to do. It's like, we just sort of don't know what to do with ourselves. We sort of try and be there and also be supportive to our friends around us, when actually deep down inside, it's like, I'm really struggling too, but I know that there are people in worse positions. So you're trying to balance that thing of like, not beating yourself up for struggling.
Yeah.
But also being sort of strong enough to know, okay, it's tough right now, but there are people who have it worse, and you also need to try and support them.
Yeah. It's just a lot of looking to the future, because, like I said, we don't have any date for anything in particular. And it's, and a lot of people have used the arts over lockdown more than ever, I think. Things like Netflix, things like, you know, it's got a lot of
people. It's what's helped people keep their sanity, I think, in lots of ways, and entertained and sorted. And then when it's just seen that it's like, oh yeah, just screw them, they'll be fine. You know, it's like very much the whole thing that you're in the arts because you love it. It's like, yes, we do love it. And there are lots of plus sides, and there's lots of flexibility and creativity, which is all very nice. But we'd also like to be able to pay our bills as well, you know.
I like being alive, you know, like eating food, drinking,
it all helps.
Sustaining my body, making sure I can breathe.
It's just,
have a roof over my head.
It blows my mind, you know. I remember, like, Billy had someone come up to him going, oh, I really liked your second album, mate. I downloaded it from LimeWire or whatever the equivalent was, you know, that kind of Napster crap. Just said that to his face. He was just like, he's like, oh, so you really liked it? And he's like, yeah, it was awesome, it was awesome. He goes, well, can you buy it next time so I can actually afford to make a next album?
Yeah.
It's like, do you not realize that you're saying this to someone who has like provided and put loads of money to stuff? Because making this stuff's not free. Even if, say, you wanted to just do a really quick painting, you've still got to buy
the paint,
pencils, paint,
canvas,
paper, whatever. Like, everything costs. Everything costs. Like, even if it seems fairly free, like with me just talking on a radio station, you know, ultimately, like, Boogaloo Radio has to pay for PR. I have to make sure I've got a working laptop to be able to stream stuff through.
Yeah.
Microphones now, I've got to keep that up. I've got to make sure I've got a phone that's always got a contract so that I can keep pushing and promoting all this stuff, because not only now are we artists, we also have to be our own sales pitch as well, and constantly keeping this going and doing all this PR and our own PA. And it's annoying that people don't seem to value it yet. They're happy to use it,
but
when it comes to actually sort of paying and valuing it, they're a bit like, nah.
Well, the thing is, like, obviously it's shit, but I just find it weird that he decided, did he like work for Napster? Why do you have to bring that in? Can't you just say, I've really liked your second album?
But these it would have also been better if he said, you know what? Album was shit. And then walked off and said, yeah, I downloaded it illegally. It was shit. It's like, it's almost like,
yeah, it's like, oh,
I loved
okay.
it so much, man. I didn't feel like I wanted to support you financially. But I loved it. So thank you.
It feels weird, doesn't it?
Super weird.
But again, like, he's had to say to people, and I've said this as well with like my show, but to a much lesser extent because I'm not as in the public eye as Billy. It's like, by all means, don't like something. It's not for everyone. That's what life is. But don't at me in it.
Yeah.
And so like Billy said this. It's like, oh, you know, loved your first album, mate, but this one was a bit shit. It was not my kind of thing. But he's like, have that opinion, but don't put at Billy Subway in, please.
It's so unnecessary.
It's like, I don't need to know that. And he's the songwriter as well. So obviously it's very much his heart on his sleeve when he's writing this stuff. So to have someone just be like, oh, by the way... It's like, why? Do you get a kick out of saying this sort of stuff to people? Or do you just genuinely not realise that these are human beings that have feelings and thoughts about stuff? Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, no, next time just spit directly in my face.
Oh, it's like, oh yeah, you know, just kick me whilst I'm already on the floor. Thanks, it's great.
Now, those are all the questions that I have for you, but I always ask listeners to send in any kind of musings or questions that they may have, and I kind of pick them out of a hat.
Okay.
Not a physical hat, I don't own...
Metaphorical.
Yeah. Well, I do own hats, I own far too many.
I was going to say, you've got hats, you should be putting
hats
stuff in there.
Hats for days.
Just pick it out like a little fishbowl on the table.
To anyone listening, she's lying, she's actually pulled 7 rabbits out of a hat. It's getting a bit troubling now.
I'm wearing 3 right now.
They're crapping everywhere. I'm not sure I'm going to clean this up.
This episode's question is from Anita Rael, and she wants to know, if your creativity was a colour, what colour would it be?
Oh, I'd say orange.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also because it's my favourite colour, but I'm naturally ginger, so I kind of feel it sums me up, orange. I also feel that it can be a happy colour, but it can also be very in your face and represent danger as well, because I don't like to take the safe option. And also just... Yeah, I'm trying to think.
You just feel like it's you.
It's also very sort of amber, which feels like that's always where I am with my career, is that I'm not quite stopped. I'm not quite go on that in between, just going, oh, come on, just change. Please go green. I want to just keep pushing forward. So yeah, I'd probably say orange for that.
Wayne?
Oh, it's a tough one. So I want to say like a deep blood red.
Nice.
Like, just, bit, you know, ox blood. Like you know, like in a film where it's like, oh, it's like in the old 70s films, like, oh, it's like really kind of like colour blood. I'm sort of like, nah, like when it got to like nowadays and it's like that deep blood red, that kind of stuff. I don't know, like, funny enough, like, I write a lot of stuff and have a lot of ideas and I sort of just sit them down and I look at a lot of them, just like, wow, there is a lot of anger here. It's like sometimes it's like, huh, I should really, really figure this out.
I think that happens a lot with creativity, though. I think a lot of it stems from stuff that's happened in your life that you want to try and rectify. Yeah. You know, I think it's a major source to creativity is like, what do I want to change? Why do I want to do something that's creative? Is it to change the world? Is it to change me? Is it to progress? I rarely think that you get like a superstar who's made like a hit single. It's like, oh yeah, this was about a really nice relationship between me and my partner where we sat on the bed eating cookies all day. Yeah. You know, the biggest hits probably are not going to be like that. There's usually some form of issue behind the scenes.
Yeah. I mean, that sounded a little bit like Kate Nash and Lily Allen, but it always goes slightly sour in their songs, doesn't it? It's never that
again,
nice.
If you delve into the lyrics and then you also see things like Kate Nash's documentary as well about the trouble she's been through, sort of trying to push through with her career.
Is that on Netflix?
It was on iPlayer for a little bit, but I think you probably guess it on Amazon, but it's well worth a watch actually, because it's just talking about how she was very much typecast as sort of a woman in the industry, and then she had a sort of label removed from her and she just had to do everything DIY. So it's really can be quite inspirational, but again, it just shows not everything's rosy behind the scenes.
It was funny because you were talking about like female-led bands. One of my favorite bands of all time is Cardigans. Yes. And the thing with the Cardigans is that like they do this all sort of very cheery music. So like Loveful, their big breakout hit was like really cheery. But when you listen to the lyrics, it's like this is a
dark, this
is a dark song about like love, like codependency gone horribly awry. So, and like a lot of their songs are like that. So it's like interesting.
Some of the best songs are like that. It's where they give the illusion of being like upbeat and lovely and on the outside, but lyrically they're really, really dark. Don't think you'd get it the other way around as much, but yeah. But what about you? What's your creative colour?
I feel like it's a swirl of like pastel yellow and pink.
Okay, yeah, I kind of see that. Because it's a bit like a raspberry ripple ice cream.
Hell yeah.
Isn't it? Because that's kind of the yellowy Cornish ice cream with the little sort of pastely pink swirl in. Yeah, that sums you up.
I think, I don't know, just when I... And also because it's my brain goes at such a speed, there is no way it's just one colour. Though, like, there's a mix of everything going on there. So yes, I'm a raspberry ripple. That would be my creativity colour. Right. On that note, we have come to the end of our time, Rowena.
Oh, thank you for having me. Sorry, like, if I just ranted too much. Like, I always end up, when it's not my stuff, I just start getting really political and angry about stuff. And I'm suddenly, at the end, I'm like, oh, I'm really sorry. No, that was a bit too much.
It's good. It needs to be heard. And you're very eloquent
with
it. You have points to be made.
I don't feel it. I sometimes feel like I'm just like, brah, 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 brah. And then I'm like, what was I saying? I've completely lost my train of thought. Oh, yeah, I'll just bring it back down to women in music. That'll be fine.
Well, thank you for coming on.
And thank you for having me.
Well, what a lovely show that was. Lovely lady, lovely vibes. But what did we learn?
We learned a lot, to be fair. But if I could quote a great man, you know, a great person, it's a song.
Go on.
Forget everything and remember, for everything a reason.
Who's that?
Ian Brown.
Oh, I should know that.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, there you go. Thank you for listening. Congratulations on making it this far. Please do follow and share, because you never know who needs some creativity, some kindness, and a little bit of chaos.
Can I add one more as well?
Here he is. Go on.
Yeah. So, because Rowena's a great guest, and we were talking about women in entertainment, I want to make one statement very clear. Something that's actually a bit of a pet peeve of mine, and something that needs to be said. If you have an entire list of films and you don't have at least a handful of female directed films, your list is shit.
On that note, we bid you good day.
Bye.
Can you stop? Remember when I told you that I have an anxiety issue?